There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. There are so many things one could preach on in this morning's very rich set of readings, but I'm going to think about the man from the land of Uz whose name was Job. It's one of the great books of the Old Testament, really substantial, fantastically poetical and rich in language. It's an extraordinary book, and I do urge you to read it. We heard the beginning of it, a somewhat filleted beginning, and to our eyes a rather unsatisfactory beginning. God and Satan seem to have a bet. Satan says to God, "You know that people only worship you because things go well with them." And God says, "That's not true." And Satan says, "Well, let's have a test case. Let's have a go at Job. You see how pious he is and also how rich he is." And God says, "All right, get on with it." And Satan destroys Job's material possessions, blasts them, and Job has nothing left except himself, his own life, and his own body, and his own health. But he refuses to give up the worship of God. So Satan says to God, round two, "If you let me afflict him in the body, then surely he will curse you." And God says, "Okay, go ahead." And so we have what we heard this morning. Job smitten with his sore boils, but he still refuses to curse God. Now, the modern reader inevitably thinks this is not a very fair way of dealing with Job. What are God and Satan up to? God is hardly in a very good light. But I can remember my Hebrew teacher saying to me, "Remember the story of Little Red Riding Hood. Mother sends Little Red Riding Hood with her basket of goodies out into the forest to take the things to grandmother." What kind of a mother sends a little girl out into a forest when she knows that there are woods there, not to mention axe-wielding woodcutters? If you start going down that line, you'll never engage with the story of Little Red Riding Hood, and so it was suggested to me with the book of Job. You have to set aside the questions that are raised by this morning's first reading and just get on into the bulk of the book, which starts by addressing that question: is our piety a consequence of our prosperity? Do we worship God because things are going well for us? And the answer to that question is no. We worship God, Job worships God, even when things are not well for him. But the book broadens out into an extraordinary discussion of human suffering and of the sense, if there is any, of innocent suffering. Job has three friends who come to comfort him. They're always called Job's comforters, but they're not really very comforting at all. And what they keep saying is, "Job, you must have done something really wicked for this to have happened to you." And Job says, "No, I'm innocent." And they say, "No, you can't be." Because the comforters work on the basis that there is no such thing as innocent suffering in our world. All suffering is in some way deserved. And if you suffer, it must be because of something that you have done. In some religious schools, it's something you've done in a previous life. The karma is being worked out in the next generation. But, say Job's comforters, you must have done something. Well, they have a go at Job across about 30 chapters of the book, and Job gives as good as he gets and insists that his suffering is genuinely innocent and he's not done anything wicked. And then a fourth comforter arrives, a man called Elihu, and he says to the other three, "Well, I thought you'd do a better job because of you being older and wiser than me, but I see that you're completely useless. Let me have a go at Job." So comforter number four has a go at Job, but essentially he's taking the same track. "Job, you have done something wrong. That's why you're suffering." Just in the way that there are people who visit the sick in hospital and say to them, "You must have done something very wicked for God to have allowed this to happen to you." And Job indignantly refuses to accept that understanding of suffering. Then in the last third or quarter of the book, God himself comes on the scene and speaks to Job out of the whirlwind. Magnificent speeches. Their rhetorical power is absolutely tremendous. The trouble again for the modern reader is that God's logic isn't entirely satisfactory. It can be summed up as more or less, "So can you organize the weather? Do you know how to make crocodiles? And we think to ourselves, well, that's hardly an answer to the question of innocent suffering, simply to harp on about the inscrutable majesty and power of God and how he can do everything. But of course, for the writer of the book and for the first generation of readers, God's answer may have been completely satisfactory. Job is in fact silenced by God's answer. At the end of the book, he puts his hand upon his mouth and he sits down. It's a gesture of defeat.